This is WMRA's Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from the WMRA newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky. Older immigrants often bring their cultures with them, and then their children begin to change those cultures.
As immigrants, we have maintained some of that attitude of separation from the other.
The story of trying to get a story about gardening from a Russian-speaking culture, wary of outsiders, plus a tour of a local governor's school, and we wrap up our in-depth series on homelessness. And we've got this week's special installment of The Spark. Stay tuned for Second Look. But first, this news. This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Andrew Jenner had a great idea for a story, but it didn't quite work out the way he expected. And so the story became a story about trying to get the story. That's coming up later, and it will all be clear. Just stay tuned. And we've also got Margie Greenfield's tour of the integrative teaching environment at the Massanutten Regional Governor's School. And this week's edition of The Spark, a special conversation with students led by JMU President John Alger. But first, Kara Lofton wraps up our in-depth series on homelessness with the somewhat surprising finding that providing affordable housing may be cheaper than the way we now deal with the problem of homelessness.
If you ask local experts, why is there homelessness in Virginia? Their answers are pretty consistent.
The answer is, of course, housing, affordable housing.
Homelessness is a housing crisis.
The cost of housing is incredibly high.
Housing is the solution to homelessness.
As part of this series, I spoke to six individuals who are working with homeless populations in Virginia. And at one point or another, they all talked about the lack of affordable housing in this area. Affordable housing means housing that is no more than 30% of one's income. Kaki Dimmick is the executive director at the Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless in Charlottesville. She said in 2010, the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness released the Federal Strategic Plan to Prevent and End Homelessness. The plan includes ending chronic homelessness, especially for veterans, ending homelessness in general, and ending homelessness in families and youth. She described chronic homelessness as
an extended period of time on the street or multiple episodes of homelessness, plus a documented disability. And that's a disability that can be behavioral, mental health, substance abuse, or a physical disability.
After the mandate, the Interagency Council on Homelessness began to identify what works to end homelessness and what doesn't work. What they found is that providing housing is really effective, especially for those who have the most need. Local agencies began to
use whatever your resource you have to address the person who has the highest need, which is both the compassionate thing but also the economic thing, because those people who have the highest needs are costing the community the most.
Locally, the economic cost of keeping someone homeless is between $22,000 and $26,000 a year. That cost includes emergency room visits and mental health services. The cost of permanent supportive housing drops that number to slightly more than $10,000, even if housing is the sole intervention the community provides.
Once people get stably housed, things start to look different. Their horizons change. They can look beyond tomorrow or the next meal, and they start to imagine their lives differently. They get connected to mainstream resources, and they consider jobs. They drink less. They have fewer medical needs. They have fewer mental health crises.
Harrisonburg Redevelopment and Housing Authority Director Michael Wong said similar programs are being piloted under the Harrisonburg Continuum of Care initiatives and are very successful. As mentioned earlier in this series, since 2012, Harrisonburg has experienced a 22% reduction in the number of folks in shelters.
A number of the individuals in the shelter are working, and they work almost full time, but they are unable to pay the deposit or the utility cost, which all adds to the challenge of being able to move into housing and then maintain that housing.
Susan Richardson is the director of Valley Mission in Stanton. Like Wong and Dimmick, she spoke at length about the challenges of living in a community with little affordable housing.
If a person is on disability, and say, for instance, they're earning $800 a month, if their apartment is $600 and it does not include utilities, then that leaves them $200 to do utilities and for insurance or food and clothing. I mean, it's pretty much impossible.
She then began to talk about the lack of a livable wage. The minimum wage in Virginia is currently $7.25 an hour. In a four-week month, that means that a minimum wage worker will earn $1,160. Since affordable housing is defined as taking up no more than 30% of one's income, that person would need to find an apartment that cost them a maximum of $348 a month. However, Harrisonburg, Stanton, and Charlottesville live in a corridor that is heavily dominated by two major state universities that drive up housing costs in their respective locales, James Madison University and the University of Virginia. A one- or two-bedroom apartment in this corridor that costs less than $348 is an almost impossible find. Dimmick weighs in.
Instead of trying to fix everyone, we're going to give them the smallest amount necessary for them to be able to solve the problem on their own. That assumes two things. One, that we'll be flexible and responsive to people's needs, but also, and this is radical, that assumes that people will take care of themselves. If you give them what they need to be out of crisis, that they have both the coping skills and the social network and those kinds of things that they can tap into to solve whatever else is going on. And that is a radical idea of treating homeless people like humans.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Early every weekday morning, 76 11th and 12th grade students from 10 high schools in Harrisonburg and Page, Rockingham, and Shenandoah counties head to Mount Jackson for a different kind of education. WMRA's Margie Greenfield went along for the ride. Check it out.
It's still dark. It's chilly. A small group of students are waiting at Turner Ashby High School at 6:45 a.m. for the bus they take every morning to Massanutten Regional Governor's School in Mount Jackson. Massanutten Regional Governor's School for Integrated Environmental Science and Technology, open since the fall of 2005, is one of 19 such schools in the Commonwealth. A variety of governor's school programs, academic year and summer, provide some of Virginia's most able students academically and artistically challenging programs beyond those offered in their public schools. With programs from the arts to government and international studies and to mathematics, science, and technology, the governor's schools serve more than 7,500 gifted students annually. Students take English, math, and science classes there and return to their public schools for lunch in the second half of the day. The most exciting part of the experience for both students and faculty is the collaborative, not competitive, nature of the curriculum. Kara Bates teaches agroecology and sustainable agriculture.
What the students see in one classroom is transferred throughout the other classrooms here, and that's so important because I think a lot of times in education, they learn about things in isolation. And while that seems to work well for preparing for standardized tests and things like that, the downfall of that is that's not how the real world works. There's nothing that exists in isolation in the real world.
Several years ago, Bates and environmental science teacher Rich Newcomer turned a planned one-day project on hydraulic fracturing into a weeks-long research project. As students researched the pros and cons of fracking, it became apparent that they felt very passionately about the topic and wanted to share their knowledge in a different format. The teachers organized the students to formally debate the topic, some pro, some con, and invited community members, local organizations, legislators, and school officials. Many Governor School students, including senior Nadia Armentrout from Broadway High School, have embraced their inner nerd.
Dealing with a nerd factor at homeschool at Broadway, I own it. I'm proud to be a Governor's School student, and if that makes me sound nerdy, then I don't really care.
Governor's School teachers come from a variety of backgrounds and experiences.
So I was in the twilight of my career, and I had 29 years in, and I was thinking about retirement. And then I got the job here, and I saw how the way education should be, in my opinion.
Environmental science teacher Rich Newcomer stayed another 9 years and will retire this year. Along the way, the topics and projects in his environmental science classes challenged him to include lessons in political science, economics, law, and sociology, and then, of course, to collaborate with his other colleagues to include statistics, writing, and agroecology. That last subject is taught by Kara Bates.
It's very student-centered here. It's not really a typical day where, as a teacher, I stand and lecture in front of the class. They're actually working on real-world problems, and they're finding unique solutions to those problems.
For WMRA News, I'm Margie Greenfield.
As a reporter, it's best if you have a pretty clear idea in mind what your story's going to end up being about. But things don't always go according to plan, and sometimes the story you end up with isn't remotely what you thought you'd wanted. WMRA's Andrew Jenner has a story about trying to get a story.
There's an apartment complex in Harrisonburg where lots of immigrants from the former Soviet Union live. Over the years, they've lined one edge of the property with a fantastic, sprawling collection of gardens where many of them, especially the elderly ones, put in hours of hard work. It's not just that these gardens are so big and well-kept. They're glorious in a ramshackle sort of way. Their fences and gates, drainage ditches, terraces, retaining walls, nearly all of it improvised from old furniture and scraps of lumber and other salvaged materials. It's the sort of stuff we might call junk, but the gardens aren't junky at all. It looks like the Shire. This was supposed to be a story about those incredible gardens and the people who made them. But it's not, because the gardeners wanted nothing to do with me.
I knew that there would be a little bit of resistance and caution for setting up an interview, but I often forget what is underlying all of that.
That's Lubov Slasheva, whose family came here from Kazakhstan in 1998 when she was 5. Now she's in dental school in Richmond. She was the one who first told me about these gardens and volunteered to be my fixer for a story about them, a translator, an insider who could vouch for my credibility. For more than a year, she tried to convince the gardeners to let me visit, but they wouldn't budge.
When we reached out to the gardeners, I did find it a little frustrating to receive their tenacious resistance, but I do understand where they're coming from, considering their history.
Slasheva's family, like much of the rest of the Russian-speaking immigrant community in Harrisonburg, belongs to a Protestant church. During the Soviet era, these people were marginalized and persecuted for that. To survive, they developed a close-knit, quiet culture, wary of attention from outsiders.
As immigrants, we have maintained some of that attitude of separation from the other.
That's helped them maintain strong bonds in their families and congregations here, Slasheva says. But the classic intergenerational growing pains that many immigrant groups go through are also coming into play now.
As younger people are assimilating into the culture and have a very different experience with both the workforce and educational systems that isn't quite as menacing, that kind of separation is no longer as useful or makes as much sense.
That meant Slasheva herself was surprised by the older generation's extreme reluctance to talk about something that seems as harmless and fun as gardening. After we'd given up on the idea, she took me to visit her grandmother, Natalia, at a retirement home in Harrisonburg. Natalia Slasheva isn't one of the gardeners herself, but she's one of their peers. And with Lubov translating, she explained their point of view.
Belarusians and Ukrainians had an especially difficult time during the Soviet Union times. As Christians, they were oppressed maybe even more than my family was in Kazakhstan. I believe that experience and history in their families has really traumatized them to fearing any kind of publicity or the eye of the authorities.
Они поэтому боятся всякого publishing.
I'd wanted to visit with a microphone and notepad for the very purpose of publicizing what they're doing. And from their perspective, that just didn't seem like a good idea at all. And so, no story. The gardens are there. They're magnificent. They're probably beginning to bloom now, and that's all I have to show for a year of trying to report on them. It was certainly worth it. I learned a lot about the gardeners, even though they wouldn't talk to me. Slash Sheva learned a lot about people she already knew well.
I think these conversations are worth having and perspectives worth keeping in mind when we interact with any kind of immigrant community.
Happy gardening, everyone. For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, and an anonymous donor.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. The on-air part of this week's Spark is actually the tail end of a conversation about the college experience I convened among three JMU students and university president John Alger. We're picking up just as future poet and farmer senior Sarah Golibart, future research scientist senior Joe Balsamo, and future music business powerhouse junior Kia Alice were asked by President Alger if they have any advice for next fall's entering first years.
I can begin. Sarah here. So my brother is just graduating from high school now. He got into JMU, so he's deciding whether he wants to come or not. So that's a bit of tension in our family.
Come to JMU. That's John.
Subtle plug. Tommy, can you hear us? One big piece of advice that I've given to him is don't take too many classes, because I know, like, when I first came to college, I overloaded myself academically, and I found that I wasn't able to delve as deeply as I could have in those classes and really, like, widen my study within that environment and talk to the professor, and because I was too worried about my other classes. Yes, GPA is important because, you know, as Joe was saying with this secondary and tertiary education that that most of us are headed towards, but also the experiences that you can have outside of the classroom, like with leadership positions or volunteering in the community, are also just as important. And so all I would say is don't overload yourself with classes. Don't think that you have to have a 4.0 GPA to be a successful and worthwhile human being. There are just so many other ways to express yourself.
I'm seeing heads nodding. Others
don't agree. Expect to get a 4.0. This is Joe. If you do it, that's great. But kind of going with what Sarah said, it's quality over quantity. You want to get the most out of the experience. Now, she said, obviously, don't overload yourself with, 20 credits? Some high amount of credits.
Sometimes I've been in, like, 21 credits. It's been heinous.
But at the same time, don't take 12 credits. You still want to challenge yourself and push yourself.
Yes,
part of the whole college thing is you need to figure out who you are as a person and what you can handle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about finding that balance.
That's terrific. And again, what I'm hearing is something of a balance, that mm-hmm. you have talked about the importance of your classes and your academic work, but also part of the college experience is what happens to you as a person, your growth as a person. And a lot of that actually takes place outside the classroom with some of the activities and relationships that you've all been describing today. So I appreciate that advice to students that are so worried about, you know, grades and the impact that's going to have on their future, that they need to have a big picture, holistic sense.
Right, absolutely. And I mean, when you're looking back on your life, you know, 20, 30 years from now, you're not going to remember studying for that one test. You're going to remember that night you had with your friends or that one special conversation with a mentor. Now, I'm not saying don't study for that test.
Just balance it.
Just balance it. It really is just this big hole. Every one of us is a trapeze artist just up there trying to balance schoolwork, family, relationships, friends. And you're going to struggle. It's okay. Everybody's going to struggle. But when you find that sweet spot, you're going to have a great time and everything's just going to fall into place. It just does.
And I'm glad you mentioned, this is John again, the importance of struggle, because actually mm-hmm. the way that you grow as a person, I believe, is to overcome obstacles and to face adversity and sometimes to try and fail at something. If you haven't ever done that, I would say to a college student, then you're not pushing yourself hard enough, that all of us in our lives and careers have experienced failure, and those have been some of the most important growth opportunities I at least have seen in my own career. Kia, how about you?
I would say that intimate moments with professors have mostly occurred from when I've absolutely fallen on my face and needed someone to say, hey, you can do this, you can pick yourself up and you can get through this, and that's how I grew. And I would say that for incoming students, whether you go to JMU or wherever, first of all, make sure that the choice of where you go is your choice. Also, when you get here,
I was just going to say one of the other groups that perhaps your advice would be useful for, and I say this as the parent now of a 10th grader in high school, is parents. As we go through this process of choosing colleges, we know that, students do hear a lot of voices and have a lot of people talking to them and giving them advice. So perhaps you can also give us some advice for the parents who are listening out there as well.
I mean, I think my parents did an excellent job of saying, you have – well, excellent might be a little bit too much, Mom and Dad, if you're listening. Too big of egos.
Oh, man.
But they did a great job of, or an excellent job of saying, you know, this is your choice, and here's the reality of this school, here's the reality of this school, and the reality of this school. But in the end, the choice is yours, and what are you going to pick? And that was, for me, very important. And it helps, too, to go on tours with people who aren't your parents. I toured JMU twice, both times without my parents, actually. And it was great because it gave me this chance to sort of stand on my own and say, how do I feel here? Not, okay, what do Mom and Dad think of here? And that was really important for me. And then once you get here as a student, there's two things that I really wish I could tell freshman year me, freshman Kia, this is Kia. And it would be, one, really enjoy those gen eds. Don't be afraid to really get, if you're a science major, but you're really into this English class that you're taking and it's interesting to you, you can enjoy it and get into it and really grow as a person from a field that might not be your concentrated field and become more well-rounded. And to explore that side of yourself that you might not have known. It might not be something that you major in, but it's still something that'll help you grow. And then also, don't be afraid to declare when you need to be alone. And then, you know, if all of your hall is going out to go do something together and you just really need time to be by yourself, you know, then take that opportunity and let yourself be alone and let yourself sort of grow. There's a loneliness aspect, I think, to your freshman year of college, because there's a loneliness to any kind of growth. And that's okay. Embrace it and really give yourself the opportunity to explore it, because that's the way we talked about struggle and growth. And that's a way that you grow through struggle, is allowing yourself to be alone and embrace yourself and get to know yourself.
And I'm so glad, this is John, that you've shared that sense of loneliness that is part of growth. I remember that feeling well when I was a college freshman away from home for the first time for a significant period. And it can be a lonely time, but it is a time when you are really trying to find yourself.
Definitely.
And
sometimes
that does involve a sense of feeling lonely, and even when you're surrounded by people, that sometimes you just need to collect your thoughts and reflect on what you're doing and who you are. So, and not to be afraid of that, I think, is a really valuable piece of advice, and important for parents to understand when students are going through that.
Mm-hmm. Kia, if I may comment on something you said earlier, Sarah here, I thought it was so amazing that your parents allowed you to tour the campus by yourself, because I feel like it's so important to give your student that independence. My parents did this thing they called assertiveness training, where they would have me go up and talk to different, like, authority figures and things like that. And so I feel like if you're on a tour with your student or your child and they want to go talk to some sort of administrator or professor, have them do it. Like, have them go up and introduce themselves, shake that hand, and make that connection and be the one.
A self-advocate, really.
Yeah, self-advocate.
That's so important. Thank you for sharing that, Sarah. As a university president, I can't tell you how many times I've had parents intervene when I really want to say, can't your son or daughter fight their own battles now and,
exactly.
and make these points? I'd be very happy to speak with them. But some parents are, as we all know, very protective. They want the best for their kids. But sometimes the best thing is to let them be their own advocate.
You can hear the entire conversation among Sarah Golivar, Joe Balsamo, Kia Alice, and JMU President John Alger on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
You'll find stories from the WMRA newsroom and more information at our website, WMRA.org. Just click on the news tab. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host, and I'll be back tomorrow morning. I'll see you then.